Okay, good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to review high-temperature superconductivity. It sounds like an impossible task if ever there were one. And so, for some reason, the following quote by a famous philosopher came to mind when I was asked to do this. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know, but there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know we don't know. So as many of you have already guessed, the name of this philosopher is Donald Rumsfeld. I think trying to provide some justification for invading Iraq. Right, exactly. Okay, so this is going to be a somewhat unconventional review of high-temperature superconductivity. And as I was thinking about how to approach this, I thought what I would do instead is approach high-temperature superconductivity through some other compounds that I don't think are going to be mentioned much in this conference, judging from the talks. Which I think have a lot to say, or at least something to say, about high-temperature superconductivity, and perhaps are somewhat simpler than the final end product of the full high-temperature superconductors. So the first system I'd like to say a few words about is the cesium copper chloride system, which is a beautiful anti-ferromagnetic insulator, a very hard insulator, and something that is amenable to very precise characterization, as I'll explain shortly. And there's some beautiful work coming out of the lab of Radu Kuldia, which I'll talk about. That's going to lead me to some layered organic materials that show a rather richer phase diagram, including what appears to be unconventional superconductivity, possibly D-wave superconductivity, but also some interesting antiferromagnetic properties. And I'll argue that these systems can be described by Hubbard-like models at half filling. So in some sense, they're a little bit cleaner than the cuprate superconductors, and yet have many similarities to the cuprates. Then I'll talk about this ladder system, which there's some very nice recent experiments on using resonant X-ray scattering. In some ways, so this is, of course, much closer to the cuprates in that we have a copper-oxygen system. This material also superconducts and is probably rather closely related to the high-TC materials, where I'll end up. And then the other speakers can take on that task. All right. So. In presenting these compounds, what I'm really trying to ask the question is, if TC were not so high in the cuprate high TC superconductors, would they still stand out among all the other interesting layered, strongly correlated materials? Well, perhaps so, but I think that some of these other materials deserve more attention than they've been receiving. So let's begin with the cesium copper chloride system. The copper, which is going to be the player of interest, has a spin 1/2 on it and lies at the center of these tetrahedra with four chlorine atoms around. And if you just count up the valence electrons, then you see this is Cu2+. So usual spin 1/2 configuration. And then there are these cesium ions. So this lives in a layered configuration. And to a very good approximation, we can think of it as a Heisenberg antiferromagnet with two exchange constants, a larger exchange constant along chains or along one dimension, and a weaker, somewhat weaker, about 1/3 weaker exchange constant in the other two directions. So this is really an anisotropic triangular lattice, which is weakly coupled between the layers. Also has some small Dalzhinsky-Maria type interactions. So the phase diagram as a function of temperature and applied field here looks something like this. At very low temperatures, we have a long-range ordered, nail-ordered, type-ordered state. But above that low temperature with the three-dimensional ordering, there appears to be good evidence for a two-dimensional spin-liquid type of behavior. Now, the interesting thing about this material is that the exchange constants are just right, that it can be fully polarized in a relatively moderate magnetic field. And by doing neutron scattering, then in this fully polarized state, and studying the excitation spectra, since we are able to understand the fully polarized, the excitations, the spin waves about the fully polarized state easily, trivially, then these exchange constants can be determined to within percent accuracy. So we know a great deal about this system. So why mention this in the context of the cuprate materials? Well, in looking at the neutron scattering, then what Kuldea and collaborators discovered is that there is a continuum of excitations reminiscent of what one would expect from spin-ons, deconfined spin-ons instead of spin waves. A single spin wave excitation should have a rather sharp spectral function. Instead, there's a smearing of the spectral weight out, which is perhaps most easily interpreted in terms of spin-ons. And furthermore, although this material has a one-dimensional tendency in that the exchange constants are stronger in this one direction than the others, the dispersion, the excitations disperse in both directions. So this appears to be an example, probably our first clear example of a two-dimensional spin liquid. All right, so some known unknowns. The question, do spin liquids exist in dimensions greater than one, has received, of course, great theoretical interest since even before the high-TC materials. But now, at least, we have some experimental evidence suggesting that's the case. Now, that leads to the question of whether topological order can be detected. Last year, around this time, here at the ITP, there was a whole workshop devoted to the question of exotic order, topological order, order, in other words, that isn't characterized by some local order parameter. And the question keeps arising, how can we get a direct detection of topological order? Now, looking at that excitation spectrum, it seems that the spin-ons are gapless or nearly so, at least within the resolution, experimental energy resolution of the neutrons. And so this leads to the question is whether gapless spin-ons are possible in greater than one dimension. We know that they're possible in one dimension from Heisenberg chain physics. And finally, we have the question of the statistics of the spin-ons. There are various proposals for fermionic and bosonic spin-ons, and can they be distinguished? So let me just remind you.
You can give any credit to Rumsfeld, though.
Yeah. Well, come back to Rumsfeld. Let me just remind you of the RVV picture of spin-ons taken from the Anderson paper from 1974. In fact, looking at a triangular lattice, much like the one describing the cesium copper chloride system, although they were thinking about an isotropic system. Here, the spins in this schematic are paired up in singlets, but we should think of it, of course, as resonating. So this is some sort of snapshot of the many-body wave function. And in this case, an excitation consisting of two spin-ons has been created. And now these spin-ons are allowed to move apart because the space in between them can be filled with these singlet pairs. So we have deconfined spin-ons and a fractionalization of the spin excitations. But not only that, as has been emphasized recently, although this doesn't break any conventional symmetries. It has translational symmetry and spin rotational symmetry and so on because of the resonating nature of these valence bonds. It does have this form of topological order, which we can see if we think about some arbitrary connection of singlet pairs and then look a moment later when these things have rearranged themselves. So we've had some rearrangement here going back and forth between these two. We notice that a line cutting through this system always intersects an odd number of such singlet pairs. So there is a Z2 quantum number that distinguishes these different ground states, and it's invariant under these fluctuations between the different resonating valence bond configurations. So it's a non-local order parameter, and it'd be of great interest to be able to detect such a thing directly. Now, of course, this has been since Anderson's work in 87, he suggested that this RVB state, of course, may describe the high TC superconductors, and so this is still of great interest. Now, on the experimental side, I mentioned that the neutrons have a limited ability, of course, to probe the very low energy excitations. So another possible probe of this material that we might like to use would be NMR. And so some experiments being carried out right now by Vesna Mitrovich and her collaborators is doing just that, and showing already that this, even this rather simple cesium copper chloride system, is more complicated than one might expect. For example, there appears to be some evidence from the NMR relaxation rate for a structural phase transition around 9 degrees Kelvin. So this work is ongoing, but should be a nice complementary probe to the neutrons. All right, so now let me turn to the organic, layered organic materials. In these kappa BEDT, TDF2, with anion X attached materials, the organic molecules pair into dimers. So we can think of this pair of two organic molecules as a single site in a triangular lattice Hubbard-like model, also, as in the case of the cesium copper chloride, anisotropic in its triangular symmetry. Ross McKenzie has argued that this material, this class of materials, bears some significant similarities to the cuprate materials, in particular this phase diagram, temperature versus pressure, where we can either control the pressure directly or through substitutional replacement of the anions, shows the following phases: a paramagnetic insulating phase, an unconventional metal which appears to have a pseudo gap or some aspects of the pseudo gap physics seen, for example, in transport measurements, an antiferromagnetic insulating phase, and also a superconducting phase that, as I mentioned, is possibly, maybe probably, a D-wave in nature. Actual experiment with a particular fixed anion species varying the pressure finds these phases as claimed over here in some sort of unconventional superconducting phase, this strange metal metallic phase, again the paramagnetic insulator and the antiferromagnet, and possible coexistence of the antiferromagnetism and superconductivity. It's in terms of what properties?
T squared. I thought that they said that there was a thermoelectric phase, and even the well-defined conformal temperature.
Yeah.
50 Kelvin or something.
Yeah, I'd say that at least the evidence for non-Fermi liquid behavior is much weaker than in the cuprates, and the evidence for some sort of pseudo gap behavior is just some soft changes in some of the transport quantities. So.
Metal insulated transition as a function of pressure at low temperatures?
At low temperatures, yes. And so, I mean, if we're getting into this phase, then that's obscuring things, but yes, up here. Now, one particular choice of the anion species is rather interesting. Copper 2 CN3, in which there appears to be, so this is an insulating system. It's on the insulating side of the phase diagram. But according to NMR on the hydrogen sites, there doesn't seem to be any evidence for any spin ordering. So if we contrast this NMR signal for the Cu2 CN3 anion with one of the other anions, which is known to antiferromagnetic order, we see nothing here that indicates any ordering. On the other hand, looking at the relaxation rate and going to the very lowest temperatures, there seems to be some power law behavior. So there's some evidence for gapless excitations in this system. So we have another candidate for a disordered antiferromagnet possibly supporting gapless spin-on excitations. And some MuSR experiments are also consistent with the absence of a spin moment in this system. So let me now return to the list of known unknowns that these class of materials provide. So again, we can ask the question, what causes the pseudogap in these layered organic materials? Is it some sort of RVD type of physics or something else going on? Here, more emphatically perhaps than in the cesium copper chloride system, is the question, do gapless spin-on excitations exist? And what sort of challenges does that prove theoretically? And finally, and this is a point that I'd really like to emphasize, is do these materials furnish an example of unconventional superconductivity with no lurking charge modulations? To the extent that we can think of this as a half-filled Hubbard-like model, then we wouldn't expect the same sort of stripy physics that has been argued to be important in the cuprate superconductors. So to the extent that this superconductivity bears any relationship to the high temperature superconductivity, perhaps this is telling us that any charge modulations that occur in the cuprates are not so directly related to the superconductivity. Now, I'd like to mention some theoretical work that came out largely inspired from last year's workshop here, addressing this question of the possible existence in principle of gapless spin-on excitations. Fakhar Assad has done some quantum Monte Carlo calculations of two-dimensional SUN Heisenberg antiferromagnets and found evidence for the case of SU4 Heisenberg antiferromagnets on a square lattice for no ordering. For example, this is looking at the structure factor for dimer ordering, and there's no particular peak, and power law behavior in the spin-spin correlation function. So he proposes a phase diagram based on this quantum Monte Carlo that is as follows. Here at this is as a function of 1 over n, so this is n equals 2, the physical SU2 case. We have a spin density wave, which is simply the Nail order. Increasing the value of n to 4, then there's a gapless spin liquid in this numerical work. And then increasing n further, there seems to be a dimerized phase, which would be in agreement with large n calculations. This is for the self-conjugate representation, yeah. So in other words, it's the one that we can think of as half-filled, which doesn't break any lattice translational symmetry at the Hamiltonian level. Oh, so he actually considered a more general model, a TJU model. All along this line, it's just the pure Heisenberg model. But he also considered allowing for charge fluctuations with actually U equals 0 and J non-zero. So some sort of hybrid Hubbard-Heisenberg model. But it's this one along this line is the line that I would like to emphasize here, which is just the standard Heisenberg antiferromagnetic, no charge fluctuations. Mike Hermerly and his collaborators answered a long-standing question about the stability of U1 spin liquids in two dimensions that might have gapless spin excitations by studying the role of instanton configurations, and argued that, at least in principle, these instantons need not confine the spin-ons. And so there is the possibility of having a gapless spin liquid phase. Finally, some recent work studying variational wave functions of a Heisenberg-like model on a triangular lattice has also provided some evidence in favor of this picture. Here, what's important is allowing for the possibility of ring exchange processes going beyond just the usual Heisenberg exchange. And this is quite reasonable from the standpoint of a Hubbard model, because even if U is quite large with respect to T, the amplitude for such processes can be quite large. And the reason for that is that even though ostensibly such a process, ring exchange process, might be of order t to the fourth divided by u cubed, there's a very large combinatorial factor in front of that term. And so it's known that such processes need to be included even in the cuprates in order to get detailed agreement with the neutron scattering spectrum at half filling. And even more so in these organic materials where U is probably somewhat smaller relative to T than in the cuprates, we should consider these things. So these ring exchange processes tend to break up the ordered state and lead to some sort of spin liquid, gapless spin liquid behavior, the spin on Fermi surface here. They look at a projected, he looks at a projected wave functions that have a gapless Fermi surface. And so by implication, the spin-ons would also have a power law behavior. There is a direct calculation of the spin-spin correlation that's consistent with that, some sort of power law behavior. I think, I would go back to this figure of Anderson's in the picture of such a spin-on, that it's surrounded by, it's a spin one-half that's surrounded by sort of a sea of these singlet bonds. Now, if we're talking about a gapless spin-on, these singlet bonds would be could be much longer range than is shown in this cartoon. In fact, we would expect that the probability for a bond would drop off of some power law as a function of the length. But still, basically, every spin is tied up into a singlet bond one way or another, except for these free spin-on excitations that we've created. And now these things can sort of swim away in this sea of singlet bonds. Okay, so now let me come to the ladder compound, this strontium 14 copper 24 041 system, which just working out the stoichiometry here tells us that this thing is self-doping, intrinsically doped with six holes in this unit chemical formula. Most of the holes go on to the chains in the system, and about 0.8 of them go on the ladder per unit cell.
Question.
Yeah. That would be a question really for the experimentalist answer, but my understanding is that, I mean, there's certainly intrinsic disorder in this material, but it's prepared in this particular ratio, and I suppose you hope for the best. But we'll see that there's a, let me come back to that question, because the experiments that I'm now going to talk about would make you ask that question. And that is some recent work by Peter Abamonte doing resonant X-ray scattering off of the ladders with this resonant X-ray scattering. Then the ladders can be distinguished from the chains. And here, at this particular energy, we're off resonance. Here we're on resonance for the oxygen 1s to 2p transition. And what Abamanti and collaborators find is evidence for a very sharp CDW at a wavelength of 5 lattice spacings along the ladder. So this is also evident at the higher energy transition, the 2P to 3D transition in the copper orbitals. And again, a sharp peak appears at the same wave vector of 5 lattice spacing. So this is rather, this comes back to the question of the doping in the ladder. The doping in the ladder is something, if we work out 0.8 holes distributed over these copper sites in the unit cell, that works out to a doping of about 0.057. So it's hard to reconcile that with a periodicity of the spin density wave of 5 lattice spacing, Sabir. Okay, good. Yes. In fact, Peter said, told me recently that they've been able to dope this and destroy the CDW, and then it reappears at a wavelength of 3 lattice spacings. Right. So clearly there's some redistribution, or apparently there's some redistribution of the charge, perhaps between the chains and the ladders. Perhaps we can think of the chains as a kind of reservoir for charge. This is just to show that the width of the peak seems to be very temperature independent, arguing that it's set by either the intrinsic disorder in the system or perhaps by quantum fluctuations. So this raises again some questions. Is the charge density wave intrinsic, or is it simply a reflection of defects and impurities? Is it true long range order? It sort of looks that way to me, but we need to understand the amount of defects in the material. If so, how do we understand this discrepancy between the wavelength of the CDW and the so-called accepted value of the doping? And furthermore, what relation, if any, is there between the CDW and the superconductivity that occurs in these ladders when calcium is substituted in for some of the strontium and pressure is applied? Now, some recent work by White, Affleck, and Scalapino looking at TJ models, TJ ladders, at various commensurate dopings. So this is corresponding to a doping of 1/8 hole doping, electron density of 0.875, found for the case of this pure TJ model, a power law decay of the density induced by the edges of this ladder. Since this is treated in an open boundary conditions with DMG, the open boundary conditions induce a CDW that then propagates into the center of the system. So we were quite surprised when we were doing some DMRG studies ourselves on ladder systems, not the TJ ladder, but a somewhat more generalized model, TJ Hamiltonian, including additional U-terms and V-terms, nearest neighbor Coulomb interactions, to find what appears to be long-range order in the CDW, in the density, the solid dots here is the density. This was actually in a study looking at the possibility of formation of spontaneous currents. Probably the more interesting result is that we find a long-range order, apparently long-range order, in the charge modulation. That was at a doping of 8%. And if we go to 4% and go to a different set of parameters for our Hamiltonian, somewhat more realistic, that would support a CDW, we see that the currents go to zero. There's no spontaneous current order. But again, we have what appears to be long-range charge order. In fact, if we can get a very good fit of that charge order, which has a rather sinusoidal form, to a Frenkel-Kantarova model, which emerges naturally in a semi-classical treatment of the bosonized system, bosonized variables. The period is in this case, the hole density, this is 0.04, so it's 1 over the hole density or 2 over the hole density. So it's commensurate with the hole density.
How many holes per
I think, let's see, two, well, I'll have, I get, always get confused when I do this. Right, it's a 2KF instability, yeah. It's commensurate with the lattice, but it, because this is a finite, a numerical system, it has to be commensurate with the lattice. So this is hard to understand from the standpoint of bosonization, because if we're at some filling factor like 8% or 4%, then the Umklapp processes, which are the processes that we usually appeal to lock in a CDW, at least from standard RG arguments, would be highly irrelevant. So the fact that numerically we appear to find long-range order, of course it could decay if we go out further, but you know, even for 8% and 200-run system, it doesn't seem to decay, leads me to question some of these standard arguments that are used to say that this can't happen. And so in this regard, I'd like to point out a recent observation that was made by Belitz, Kirpatcher, and Rohrbühler, which I think Dietrich is going to talk about later in this conference, pointing out simply that if we have an RG equation involving a marginal operator and also a irrelevant operator, this irrelevant operator can be dangerously irrelevant. So in this case, this has dimension 2. It's going to be going rapidly to 0 as we go to long length scales. But if it enters into the flow equation for the marginal operator in this logarithmic way, then it can have a drastic effect on the flow equations for this marginal operator. So whether something like that is going on here or not, I don't know. But there's various curvature terms that need to be considered. It's still commensurate. So it's always we're always looking at a commensurate situation. Just numerically, so I wouldn't expect that we could have an incommensurate CDW. That certainly seems unlikely.
What is the surprise then?
So, well, the surprise is that the standard arguments in terms of Umklapp terms, which would be driving this, just don't seem to work. We would have to push, so this Umklapp term is some horrible multi-fermion operator, and to get its dimension down to something reasonable just requires pushing the exponents too far. So it doesn't seem like a plausible scenario. At 1/8 filling, perhaps, or 1/4 filling, perhaps, but not at 0.08. All right, so I'm basically finished. I'll just show you, close with this snapshot of the final of some of the modulations of local density of states in this BISCO material, and I'll conclude with the theme that I began with. We have a few more known unknowns. Are charge modulations important or a red herring? Is there a hidden and or topological order in the cuprates? Do the ladders in some sense explain high TC superconductivity? And is the quantum phase transition paradigm misleading, as evidenced by this simple calculation with the ladders? OK, so let me conclude, after all those unknowns, with a known known, as someone anticipated. As you know, you have to work with the materials you have and not the materials you want. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
By one of the last things you mentioned, are letters in one way. It was a question that maybe you succeed and say, but in which way would you think that letters would be would explain ITC superconductivity? Why do you put it there?
Right. Well, we know that theoretically it's very easy to get strong D-wave superconducting correlations in a ladder system, in a doped two-leg TJ ladder. And furthermore, one can then imagine weakly coupling these ladders together. And by sort of standard arguments, Kivelson and collaborators have shown that one could easily reach very high TCs, you know, using typical numbers for the TJ values. Having TCs on the order of 100 Kelvin is not hard to achieve. Now, what's the problematic about this is that when we then go to the full two-dimensional system, eliminate the anisotropy in the one dimension versus the transverse dimension, then the numerics are much less clear, and there's very little evidence for strong evidence for D-wave superconductivity from straight numerics. Whether that's simply a limitation of numerics applied to two-dimensional systems, or there's something more important happening is I think unknown. But perhaps this question is meant to be provocative in the sense that we're much effort trying to understand the superconductivity in the full layered cuprate materials, and yet these latter systems show this superconductivity, and our theoretical methods work much better for them. So perhaps we're expending a lot of effort where it maybe is not as justified. That's deep a thought I can offer. Probably someone else has a better insight.
Brad, you mentioned the possibility of gap of spin-ons in two dimensions. Is your sense that they will exist at a quantum critical point or in a phase, if they exist at all in two dimensions?
Right.
And then I'm talking about in the ground state.
Right. Well, within various large N theories, for example, the bosonic SPN theory that Subir and Nick Reed developed, then one can have a topologically ordered Z2 phase with some gap full spin-ons. But then as you get to the boundary of this phase, for perhaps with an antiferromagnetic phase, which has gapless Goldstone modes, then you would expect that the gap for that spin-on to go to zero. So that would be this one of the two scenarios you mentioned, where we're at some phase transition, and so the spin-ons would be gapless. So that's one possibility. But I guess the one I've been thinking about more in this talk is the possibility of an actual phase that has these gapless spin-ons in it, perhaps fermionic spin-ons existing over some range of parameters.
I think one should distinguish the gapless spin-ons between situations like in the Z2 spin liquids, where they're fermionic spin-ons which are weakly interacting, essentially non-interacting, as opposed to these ones you were talking about, where
right.
It's the critical phase,
right.
Where the spin-ons are not really sharp excitations, actually.
Right. Right, so there's a gauge, massless gauge field that is trying to pull them back together, and there's some.
Which of those two categories would you imagine is easier?
I'd like to remain agnostic about that point.
Well, just a general thing. You talked about ladders, how you can do calculations on these things and get superconductivity. Supposing you can describe a lot of properties of the phase diagram, but you can't find any evidence that the ladders exist in two-dimensional superconducting. Is that a good way to go there? Structural evidence from experiment.
Right. Yeah, sure. I mean, apart from the materials that are deliberately have ladder geometries, I mean, theoretically, we're used to that idea of thinking about taking some one-dimensional things that we understand more or less and then starting to weakly couple them. But of course, as soon as we get to this isotropic point, then that whole approach is questionable. I guess the both experimental and theoretical question is whether this superconductivity or the rest of the phase diagram of these telephone book ladder compounds is qualitatively different or not from the full, you know, the standard cuprate materials. And I don't have an answer to that question. Right. If you talk to the bosonization experts, then they'll just go through the standard argument classifying the dimensions of these Umlaut terms. I agree, yes. Yeah, I'm not so surprised, but
Um,
Right. These are all short-range interactions, so the, but the only nearest neighbor Coulomb interactions. Right. So I believe this is the first example of a CDW occurring at this kind of wave vector, so not looking at a quarter filling, for example. So then in that sense, it was surprising.
Okay, so I'll move on. Thank you very much, Barry.
Thank you.